formally start this part of our program.
Will it interrupt? I'm sorry.
That's a good question. Very good, Herb.
We can take a break when dessert arrives. Yeah, arrives soon. I had an opportunity to work with Herb on a project since the latter part of last year, and of course I've known about his work ever since I've been in this field, and had the opportunity to meet with him through projects like ICANS. But I wanted to. We were discussing at the alcohol program last year about Bob Borkenstein's legacy and the early days of ICATS and alcohol and traffic safety toxicology, and Herb's name came up in more than one of those conversations, and we were very pleased when he agreed to come and join us at our meeting this week, and did a great presentation for the class yesterday about kind of the context in which field sobriety tests were developed back in the 1970s. But we wanted to take the opportunity tonight to spend some time reflecting a little more on just the early days of alcohol and traffic safety research. And I know, Herb, that you were involved with Bob Borkenstein and worked with him, so this is just an opportunity to kind of reflect on that, and for us to quiz you about your experience in working with him and working with in the early days of ICANS. So do you have some opening comments or reflections you wanted to share?
I wasn't into Bob. I mean, he really, I didn't work on any direct projects with him, except working on being a member of ICATS. I was an early member of ICATS when it was an old boys club, essentially. I mean, I at the time I joined. Pardon me?
Even at that time?
Well, I mean, it was really an old boys club. I think it had 20 members.
Wait, what year? What year?
Now you're pushing me. It must have been mid-60s.
And who were the 20 members?
I remember Goldberg. The big wheels were Borkenstein, Goldberg, Dabowski, and there was a guy who was the head of the British, the executive secretary of the British Medical Association.
John Havard.
John Havard. That's right.
Wait, who Goldberg?
The Goldbergs, who was professor of the alcohol treatment center or hospital at the Karolinska Institute.
Leon, so from AFIP.
Leon.
Leon Goldberg. He's back at the beginning of alcohol
treatment.
Well, treatment methodology to detect.
If you're talking about the guy in ICATS, it was Leonard, I believe, not Leon.
He was Wayne Jones's supervisor.
Yes, yeah. As a matter of fact, I was there. I had visited him. I think it was 61. I visited him, and he tried to talk me into coming and joining him, and he had just gotten Wayne Jones to come there, and he was talking about what a wonderful time we would all have together, and I said, I'm in California, and well, you don't know my history, but after I got my doctorate, I taught for a year at the University of Utah, and that was enough. I went back to Southern California.
Herb, where did you get your education?
Well, I got my bachelor's degree in physics and engineering at Berkeley, and I got my master's and doctorate and postdoctoral work at UCLA.
Okay.
All UC. And but anyway, I remember when Wayne first came there, we were discussing what life was going to be like working for Leonard. But anyway, it was really very much an old boys club, and
no women at all.
remember seeing one.
And you would remember.
And I think I would have recognized. I would have recognized them. In fact, actually, one of my major contributions to ICATS occurred about 10 years later when I got up at one of our meetings and said, this organization can't keep going this way, and that it really should be opened up to more young people and more be more diversified geographically as well. I mean, we had nobody from the developing countries, nobody from Asia, and this old boys club felt that they were kind of the initiators and the investigators and the, I wouldn't say that they were the investigators.
Instigators.
Instigators. More like it. Instigators. And they really didn't have the conception of what I think most contemporary professional societies have, which is to try to bring everybody in who's working in the field. I had some allies, Mark Hulenoyla, at the time, and one or two other people, and we managed to get them to set up a membership committee with a much broader a view of you didn't have to be anointed in order to become a member. I think that may have been because the early ones, the early members were all deeply involved in public policy. And I think they were used to being movers and shakers in their country. So they really had a different idea about the nature of ICAT. In fact, I think the revolt I led at that meeting was probably my major contribution.
What meeting? What meeting was that?
It was one of the our annual meetings of ICAT. I mean, we meet somewhere. I mean, the conventions would be every 2-3 years, but there would be interim meetings in between. So that's so much of the gossip about my participation in ICATS.
Now, did you attend the ICATS meeting that was held here in Bloomington?
No, I was not at the first. I was at the London one. I was at most. I went to one in Australia. I missed one in Australia. I got sick and missed it. But I think Marcy and somebody else from my shop went, and so forth.
How did you get into this line of research?
Well, that's very interesting. I did my doctoral dissertation on inducing thirst in rats. When I say inducing thirst in rats, I had been struck by the fact that people drink even when there's no physiological reason to have thirst. In fact, there was a movie that I'm sure most of you have seen on TV that was made in 1943 with Bogart and several others called Sahara. Have you ever seen that movie? Do you?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a movie about the war in North Africa between the British and the Germans, you know, El Alamein and so forth. And, you know, that war went back and forth several times. And Bogart was with a crew in a tank, and they got separated in the battle. And they were plodding along through the desert by themselves. And they had picked up a motley crew, a Senegalese trooper on the way, and so forth. And they ended up at this fort. I'll give you a history of movies. They end up in this fort where it was supposed to be water as a place. And they get there, and they still got a little water. And it turns out that there's no water. It's a very tiny fort. And when they're there, there's a German company of 200 men who also become isolated from the Germans, and they're looking for water. And they come to the same fort, and they surround the fort, and they're trying to get in. And in the movie, they kept saying, well, we'll let you go if you let us get to the water. And they would do things like they had one a flask of water, they would raise their hands and dribble the water and then re-dribble it, you know, to make believe like they had the water. And it ended up finally with the Germans surrendering because they were without any water, and, you know, the Sahara, it's hot. And I walked out of the theater, and I saw a line of about 150 people waiting to drink at the water fountain in the lobby of the theater. I only give you this. I mean, that isn't the theoretical underlying of my dissertation. But it's clear that you can induce, at least in humans, thirst. In fact, there's a famous New Yorker cartoon of this saloon. In the back of the saloon, they've got a painting of a parched desert with skull and bones and everything. And you see the people in front of the bar, three deep, with their glasses out, waiting to get drinks. So, I did a dissertation trying to educate rats to drink when they weren't thirsty.
When you were doing this, did they have animal rights organizations back in that time?
No, actually it was a very interesting experiment because in order to induce thirst, it was almost like a Pavlovian experiment where you ring the bell and you get the dog to salivate because you're hanging a piece of meat, and after a while you can don't have to have the piece of meat, you just ring the bell and they salivate. Well, I did it by inducing thirst with hypertonic saline solutions, which I would inject into the rats in large quantities to induce very rapid thirst, because in the normal functioning of the body, that's why you're thirsty, because you don't have enough water to dilute the saline. And you have to train the rats. It was very interesting because you don't want the rats so disturbed that they're not going to be participating. So you have to get the rats to love you. So I spent weeks petting the rats and letting them run over my body and stroking them to make, so that I could literally pick, when I didn't have a tremor like this, pick up the rat in my left hand and take a hypodermic needle and go in into their back and inject it, and I knew what was coming, and they wouldn't bite. They were loved me so much. So the funny part about it was when I put the rats in the apparatus again, that afterwards they drank, but the rats who I handled with placebo also did it. So somehow or other they learned to become hungry. So there was some learning of thirst, but it had nothing to do with the experimental variable that I was manipulating. But it was a very interesting result nevertheless, and they did give me my degree and kiss me goodbye. So then I went for a year to the University of Utah. And
what department?
Psychiatry. And I was going there as a basic researcher who was going to do a little extra clinical work, but a rat runner. And they had promised me about $90,000, which was a lot of money in those days. Remember, we're talking 1957. That was enough to fix up a Quonset hut. Remember, they were still using Quonset hut after the war. The psychiatry department was on the grounds of the county hospital, which was at the medical school service. And so about a month after I got there, and I learned how to breathe again. You didn't get that when he got it.
I got it. The altitude.
Right.
Dryness and altitude.
Yeah, I spent most of my time sitting. I went in and said, you know, I'd like the money and to set up my lab. And they said, well, we've just been authorized to have a new medical school. And the federal government is giving us 90% of the cost. We have to pay 10%. And instead of getting this crummy little lab for $90,000, you can now design this $900,000 space. And I nodded. And then I asked around. And I said, when do you think this is going to be done? And they said, if it's done in 10 years, we'll be like, actually, they finished in 9. By the time they were done. So almost from the first month that I arrived, I knew I wasn't going to stay. So I did a lot of other little things, which you won't bother to entertain you with, or to entertain the psychiatry department at the time. And I left and I came back to LA, and I'm looking for a job. And in fact, I got an offer. I went to thing. I got an offer from U of Washington. And one of the things that went on was I found that I didn't enjoy the snow in Utah, and I didn't enjoy the winter isolation. So I asked about Washington and was told, if you like to be in the rain 6 months out of the year, you'll love it. And so I decided to look for a job in LA. And there was actually no job, but people liked me for one reason or another. And I applied to a job at UCLA and a job Cal State LA, and there were no jobs, but they people wanted me in both places, and they said, we will go out of our way to try to make a job for you. And before we go through this trouble, are you committing to it? Because people are putting themselves on the line. There was no real job and so forth. And I said, well, I don't have anything that I want to go to otherwise. I'm sure what... And then I figured that one would come and I would be able to say the other, forget it. Believe it or not, both of them arrived within 24 hours. And I had committed, so I took both jobs. And what happened was, at Cal State, they had a lot of evening jobs. A lot of evening classes, so I volunteered to teach all evening courses, which they all loved. So in the daytime, I was at UCLA on my research job, and at night, I was teaching four courses a semester at LA. But to get back to the story, the job I got hired at was in the psychiatry department, and they wanted a basic researcher, and they decided to hire me on the basis of my dissertation on thirst and the induction of thirst, because they thought I might be able to explain why people drink alcohol, which I think is a big joke. You know, but I wasn't going to, you know, argue with them.
Disabuse them of that thought.
Yes. So I took the job, and I converted it into, I didn't know anything about alcohol at all. Nothing except what I drank. So I decided I'd sit down. I spent a couple of months sitting in my lab reading like mad. Oh, and the other thing was, with the job, the next year came a laboratory at the Brain Research Institute, which was offered to me. So it was a very funny series of events. But anyway, after reading the literature for a while, I came to the conclusion that most of the literature sucked, and that it was very inconsistent, and I couldn't believe half of what I read. And I decided, before worrying about alcoholism, I would first try to figure out what alcohol did, because I suspected that it might have something to do with why people drank. So I began looking for animal models of the effects of alcohol. Anyway, that's the beginning and end of the story, because I then spent the rest of my time.
Tell us about the jump from animals to human research.
Well, as I mentioned in my talk, I had gone through a lot of behaviors in animals, looking for significant measures of psychomotor performance. The dominant method for measuring alcohol effects on rats' psychomotor effects was developed by the Russians, and it involved a plane, and they put the rat at the top of the plane, and then they increased the angle of the plane until the animal slid down, and that was the criterion for what the effect of alcohol was, the angle at which the animal fell. And I tried that, and as a function of different BACs, and I found that, as I mentioned in my speech, not specifically with that, but I've got some kind of allergy ever since I came here. My nose has been running. That it was highly variable, that it wasn't going to be a sensitive measure of anything. So I developed another method of hanging animals on a single horizontal bar where you put their paws on it and you let go, and they're up about 20 inches above a cushion. They don't know it's a cushion. They're hanging on for dear life. And there was a correlation between the BAC and how long they hung on, which had less variability but still stank. And then I decided to look at things like tolerance, and I trained animals to escape from a shock chamber by pulling a chain, and measured whether or not, as a function of experience with alcohol, they did it or not do it faster in the future, which they did do. And I studied the effects of, because a lot of the theories of alcoholism had to do with the theory that it affected emotion. I trained animals with negative and positive reinforcers, and examined the effects of alcohol, and found there was no difference whether it was a negative or positive reinforcer. So much for alcohol as a anxiety reducer in rats. And then I did a bunch of studies on brain implants in the limbic system to see if alcohol affected their motivation or anything. And again, I didn't think much of the results. And then I decided to go into vision, because of all the literature on the one sure place where there was a reliable effect of alcohol, which you could say existed independent of any subjective evaluation, be it by the individual under the alcohol or by some other person, was in driving. I mean, you know, you had all this epidemiological stuff, and you got more alcohol, you got more accidents. I looked at it, and I came to the conclusion that vision was a major factor, and that's when I started my work in vision. And then I did that rat experiment, which is too bad you missed. I cut it out. What?
You taught the rats to drive.
No, I taught them. I was studying their ability to discriminate brightness differences, and I taught them to discriminate brightness differences, and then I gave them alcohol, and I gave them enough alcohol. As I mentioned, it was roughly a quarter of the lethal dose. I gave them 0.83 grams per liter, and I never knew exactly what the total body water concentration of rats were, but I thought that being a mammal, it was going to be somewhat close to humans. And since when I gave the dose, I played with a lot of doses. Then you spend 3 months playing with doses and seeing what they
do. Did you measure concentrations and metabolites and stuff at that time?
No, because it was very expensive to get samples out of the animal and get an analyte. remember, that was before they had gas chromatography machine. They were going to do it by the Smith-Widmark method. And, you know, people can do it reliably, but, you know, it's like the breathalyzer. Guys look at the color of a column, you know, making a judgment of what it is. And I'm sure that it was somewhat good, but if you're doing it with rats and you're going up small doses, you're not going to get very far. I felt that I was better off looking at curves as a function of dose. But anyway, I screwed around with figuring out what was an effective dose similar to 0.10, and I doubled the dose that I used. 40% of the animals lied down and wouldn't move, and four times the dose was the LD50. And if you figure it out, the LD50 for humans is 0.45. And so it was almost exactly the same as humans.
So they didn't metabolize it much faster like many other drugs?
You mean the rats?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether they metabolized it faster, but remember, I'm giving them the dose and waiting a half hour and testing them. I mean, they're not going to zip it out. Is there any evidence that rats metabolize faster?
Much faster. Most drugs, they metabolize much faster. But I don't know about alcohol specifically. But most other drugs, they metabolize much faster.
And is that through the liver?
Yeah, primarily through the liver.
Yeah.
This might be a good time to take a break so that Harp can finish his dessert.
Oh, yeah.
Pass me that recorder, and then we'll pick up and do it in another.
I don't want you to record this.
That's okay.